I think Al forgot one of his announcements here. I got to make an announcement. I don't know if this was left here last year or this year, but I think it belongs to a woman, though, because it's got lipstick on it. So I'm going to move this right now. Somebody's snot rag. Hi, my name is Chuck O'Neill, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. I really appreciate being here. I've got a lot of people to thank, but first I have to tell you this, and I'm serious when I say this. I've got the mother of all head colds. This ear is completely plugged. I feel like I'm talking in a pillow. And if I stand like this, then it's okay. This ear clears up. But I don't think you could hear me if I stood like that. So if I'm talking too loud, make some kind of non-obscene gesture, and I'll know that. Sandy's already told me that she's going to let me know, but obscene gestures aside, I don't want to get into that. I want to introduce my wife, Sandy. Don't stand up yet, because I want to thank Sam and Shirley for hauling us around, picked us up at the airport, drove us all around Houston, took us out to eat at some wonderful places, and have really befriended us and feel like I've known them forever. What I'd like to do is I'd like to have Sandy and Shirley stand up. Would you stand up, ladies? Sandy and Shirley. The reason I asked both of them to stand up is because those are two of my higher powers. Sandy noticed I had a red spot on my sleeve. She corrected my collars, told me to pull my shirt, what do they call these things, out of my pocket. Shirley asked me if my fly was up. I don't know what I'd do without him, you know. Thought I left my mom superior, but I guess she's here in Shirley. It's been a lot of fun. We really enjoyed ourselves. And I brought cold down here with me. I can't even blame you Houstonians for giving me a cold. I had it when I got here. When we left Superior, it was about 4 above 0. And when we got off the airplane here, well, you all know what it was. I'd like to thank Julie and the committee for asking us to be here today. It was a pleasure. When I heard that I was coming to Houston and coming to Texas, and I thought, wow, that's something I've always wanted to do. Show me your hands. Have any of you ran into this situation where you've got a little bit of music come into your mind and you can't get rid of it? Have any of you ever had that happen? All right. Well, Julie called me up, I don't know how many months ago, 6 months ago, 8 months ago, sometime, and asked if we'd come down here. And naturally, this piece of music went through my mind. And I don't know, the Texas Tourism Bureau had this thing on TV, and it was Lyle Lovett singing into a phone. He's going, that's right, you're not from Texas, that's right, you're not from Texas, that's right, you're not from Texas, Texas loves you anyway. I'm a Lyle Lovett fan. I think he's a great guy. And that song just stuck, and every time that somebody would call me from Texas to see how I was doing, or Sam would call and give me some information, here we go. That's right, you're not from Texas. Great ad. It sure worked for me. I'd like to thank Julie again for the bag of goodies in the room. That was great. I mean, there was a big bag of stuff. There was some crackers and bananas and fruit and thing of coffee, one that looks like chocolate milk when it's coffee, and there was some candy. When I bring Sandy with me to a conference, I never get to see the candy, so I don't know what kind of candy was in there. She just grabs that stuff out of there like crazy. You know, the alcoholics can understand that, I'm sure. And again, Julie and Mary Lou took us out to breakfast this morning. We went to Le Peeps or something like that. Is that what it means? Le Peeps? Yeah, it must be Texas talk or something, Le Peeps. Anyway, we went there in Julie's Mercedes, and I got the feeling like she thinks she's Janis Joplin, you know. Just see me, a Mercedes Benz. And George and Bev, I want to thank you guys. It's been nice to see you guys again. We see George and Bev every once in a while. They're doing a taping. And I mentioned this to somebody here this weekend. I don't remember who it was. There's only been a couple conferences that I've gone to where I haven't known somebody. It seems like I've always known somebody at a conference, and that really makes it feel good. And I know quite a few people, half a dozen of them anyway, at this conference. So I appreciate that. Pat English, Betty, I've seen someplace before. She was up here, and I know I've seen her someplace. Marty, seen Marty before. And it's just cool. And then I've got it written down here, because this is what I scratched these down so I don't forget to say my thank yous. Actually, this is the revised version. This is the little thing that they give you for your key. That's what I wrote my notes on. I thought, you get up there, you ain't going to see nothing. I mean, you're deaf, you're blind, you're just... This is like an old Labrador Retriever, you know? Getting old here. Okay, I've got all that stuff done. I thanked everybody. Oh, and then I wrote someone else. I saw somebody yesterday that I knew, and I didn't know their name, and I haven't seen them since, so I know somebody else here, too. That's always kind of cool. Kind of way my life goes. And I just noticed this now, and it's just coming into my mind. My mind works like a clothes dryer. I don't know if you know that or not, but you know, you put the wet clothes in the clothes dryer, and you turn it on, and the clothes start drying, and they start fluffing up and getting bigger and bigger and bigger until they're done. That's the way my mind works, because stuff comes in, and Lord, what comes out. And I don't know where it comes from, and I don't know what's going to happen with it, and I just pray that it's going to work out okay. I don't know about this raffle. And when Al first said raffle, I didn't know if he was talking about rifle or raffle. Raffle. I don't speak Texas, so... I don't know if this thing is fixed or not, but here's some tickets up here already. Here are already some tickets. Keep that in mind when you don't win the Gilded Lily. I got to say, too, that Blanche, I've known Blanche for quite a number of years, and I always enjoy listening to Blanche. I have a resentment towards her today, though. I don't know where she is. I can't see her right now. But believe me, I'm resenting you wherever you are. Stood up here. I gave her a good Al-Anon hug after she got done with the story. And she says, y'all sound like you come off the set of Fargo. Yeah, sure, eh? I suppose. It's not my fault I talk like a dork. Oh, it's 8:36, and I better get going. We got a clock up here. That's pretty cool. It's either fast or slow. Yeah, it's a little bit fast, so you guys are lucky. Tom, I've been in Al-Anon for about 20 years. I really don't remember my first meeting. And why should I? Living in a total blackout and denial and everything else, how could I remember what day I went to Al-Anon? Couldn't remember what day I changed my shorts. You know, that's just the way it was. That was my life. I was constantly in a state of constant turmoil, and I'm sorry if I'm talking kind of slow, but that's just the way I do things. I just realized that as I was trying to say two words at once. Hurts my tongue. I already got an earache and a sore throat, might as well bite my tongue off. But anyway, I was always in a state of turmoil, and I grew up, I was a tall, skinny kid. I was always picked last or second to the last for team sports all the time. And if I was picked second to the last, I felt a lot better because there was somebody below me that I could say, oh, is that guy crummy? You know, he hasn't got picked yet, and I have. And I really remember feeling that way. Wore glasses ever since I was like 6 years old. I got an 8-year-old granddaughter. She just got glasses, and she feels proud as punch. I picked her up at school one day last week, and she was sporting her new rims. Boy, was she cool. She was wearing them glasses, you know. I remember when I got glasses, I felt like an idiot. And she feels great. Now, isn't that wonderful that she can do that? And she wouldn't take them off. She went to bed without them, but I mean, other than that, she didn't want to take those glasses off. She was really proud, and I'm glad of that. Cutest kid, I'm telling you. The only granddaughter I have, I always tell her, Tosh, you're my favorite granddaughter. She says, Grandpa, I'm your only granddaughter. So that's okay. But I grew up in a drinking family. I live in Superior, Wisconsin. It's at the western tip of Lake Superior. I watched the Weather Channel today, and they said it was 15 below zero in Duluth. So, you know, it's kind of a cool climate up there. And it's cold, and it makes the cold makes people drink. Well, I always heard. You guys down in Texas must not drink. But we lived in a working-class town. It's about 24,000 people. Sandy and I grew up within 6 blocks of one another. And when we were growing up, we didn't know one another. We lived on the wrong side of the tracks. We were in the poorest part of town. And I don't know about Sandy. I shouldn't say I don't know about it. I know she had a ball growing up. So did I. It was a good part of town to grow up in, and we had a fierce sense of pride. And now that part of town's been revitalized into things like beer warehouses and stuff like that. And so now it's an industrial park where it used to be homes for low-income families. Sandy's parents didn't drink. Her dad had the plug in the jug for 40 years. My parents did drink. And every Friday night, when it was payday, my dad and we all would go to the neighborhood bar. Now, we got 24,000 people in town approximately. We had 89 bars. So it wasn't too far to go to a bar. And the bars were family bars. You know, people bring their kids. And my brother Jim and I have one brother. He's younger than me. We'd go to the bar, and my dad would sit at the bar and drink beer and talk railroad because he works for the railroad. Superior is a shipping town. Lots of railroad, lots of ocean-going freighters coming into Superior. It's like, I don't know, a couple thousand miles from the ocean, but they come up the Great Lakes, and they can go as far as Superior and Duluth. That's the end of the Great Lakes. So anyway, my dad would talk railroad with the railroad guys, and they always wore the bib overalls, and they had like grain dust on their faces, and they smelled good. They smelled like grain, you know, and sweat and all that. And I always wanted to be a grain door man when I got older. I wanted my dad's job. And he would tell me, no, you don't want that job. And I could never understand that. He used to say, I hate my job. And I always wondered why I stayed. You know, I didn't realize that sometimes you get into something you can't get out of. But we'd go in that bar. He'd sit at the bar, and my ma would sit in the booth with the other women. And because in Superior, Wisconsin, at that time, it was against the law for women to sit at the bar. So you women think you got it rough now. Just went back then. You couldn't even sit at the bar. It was against the law. It wasn't your old man telling you couldn't do it. It was the mayor and the city council telling you couldn't do it. And my brother and I would play pool and eat chocolate bars and drink grape soda, and that was our Friday and Saturday. Go over and watch wrestling on TV back when wrestling was not conducted by these testosterone-driven things that go by Goldberg and Faith and Kill and stuff. It was these smaller guys that just tore each other apart. And we're really, I mean, back then, the wrestling back then was kind of like Sesame Street is right now, you know, it was that mild. But that's what we do, that was our nights out, and we enjoyed it. Was there alcoholism in my family? I can't say that. I don't know. I know my life was affected by drinking. I know that the arguments that happened in our home are usually came after drinking. Either one or both were drinking. Sometimes it was funny. You know, I don't remember. I remember one traumatic thing happening when my mom and dad were arguing, and we were out at a cabin, and they were really arguing fiercely. And I got in between the two of them, and I just screamed at them to stop it. I said, you don't give a damn about Jim or myself. All you think about is yourself. And they stopped arguing right then. So, and I don't remember how old I was. I was probably around 12. And I look back at that now in my Al-Anon life now. I look back at that and think, man, even back then you were getting in the middle and trying to stop things. And it worked. So is that reinforcement or what? You know, if it works, just keep doing it. I remember getting in the middle of fights, and my buddies were getting a fight in the bar, you know, and one day I woke up, and God, I had this big, huge black and blue mark on my arm. Well, my shoulder got in the way of some guy that was going to hit another guy in the face, and they were best friends and totally drunk out of their minds. I was just totally drunk. I wasn't out of my mind yet, so I stopped the fight. And I want to say right now that I did drink. I drank a lot. I'll tell you about when Sandy and I met. I had been in the service, gotten out of the service. I was about 23 years old. Back in Superior, back in the early 60s, there was what was called a 21-year-old law. You had to be 21 years old to drink hard liquor or any kind of liquor in town. However, the bars out in the county could serve beer only. If they only served beer, they could serve 18-year-olds. So, and that was out of the city limits. And it was just so many miles out of the city limits. It had to be that way. So we would drive out into the county because there would be younger people out there, and we would sit in these beer bars. It was nothing to put on 150, 200 miles on a Friday night or maybe a Tuesday night, just to go out in these bars and drink. And a lot of kids aren't around today because of that, because of those trips out into those bars and coming back home just totally schnockered and killing themselves and a few other people along with them. It was a very common occurrence. Sandy was born with a guy that three of them got killed in a car accident that very same day. She had an argument with him, so she didn't go with. And he never came back. And it was very common. But anyway, the reason I bring that up is because my friend Dale invites me to go out to the bar with him out in the county. And this was a Wednesday night. I didn't have nothing going on. I didn't have a girlfriend or anything like that, you know. And I just thought, well, sure, we'll go out and have a couple of beers. We get out to the bar, and we order our beers, and we're sitting in the booth, which is kind of odd because usually the guys didn't sit in the booth. I didn't give it a second thought, though. And at some point in time, the door opens up, and it's Dale's girlfriend, Nancy. And she comes in with this beautiful girl. She was really stunning, you know. And me, I'm not a man of the world. I was over in France for 2.5 years, but when I came home, I was almost as innocent as when I left. Almost. Not totally, almost. I got to brag about a little bit, you know. I wasn't quite as pure as the driven snow. But anyway, when Nancy walked in, I thought, she's bringing that girl over here, and they're going to sit with us. And it was like, you ever want something but not want it? You know, you kind of think like, man, I wish I had that, but I quit. Don't think I can handle it. Well, that's what I did when I saw Sandy. Man, I wish I had that. But, oh, God, you know, I'd have to talk to her. I'd have to, I'm just, you got to do stuff. You just can't look at it. I couldn't put her on a shelf or anything, you know. And, yeah. So anyway, they sat down across from us. And I'm thinking, you know, Dale slid in next to me. I'm thinking, well, this is a bummer, you know. Here I got to look right, and it was Sandy, by the way. I had to look right across from her. And I remember to this day what she was wearing. It was a tight black sweater. And it's the sweater I remember, you know. Right. I said I was almost totally innocent. But fantasy is a big part of my life. It was a big part of my life. So is today. And she had this head of hair on her that if you were growing up in the 60s, you probably remember this. It went way, way up, and it was curling, like that fountain over here. You know that fountain? Yeah, we saw that fountain today. That's what it looked like. It looked like a root beer float because she had it frosted. Yeah. Pretty cool. And she's looking at me, and we're trying to make small talk, and she says, my name is Chuck, and I'm Sandy, and I didn't remember her name because I'm thinking about me, not about her. What's she going to think of me, not what I think about her. And she asked me where I worked, and I was at that time I was working in an auto parts store. And I said, I work at blah, blah, auto parts. And she kind of went, oh. And naturally, I took that O for ugh. I thought, well, there goes another one. I didn't even get to talk to her hardly, and she's already gone. She doesn't like me. Well, then she did something that I don't know if it was an accident or not. Frankly, I don't want to say it was, because if it's not, then I guess it's fantasy, see? Her foot went up my pants leg and touched my leg right above the ankle. G-spot. Cool. I didn't know nothing about G-spots or erogenous zones or any of that stuff. I didn't know any of that. But I sure had a lot of dreams of it. That fulfilled my fantasy, and it took me into other fantasies for weeks afterwards. Right up until consummation. I ain't going to say when that happened. But anyway, it was like, no, we doubled a couple times. We double dated a couple times. And then we started going out with our, just Sandy and I. And it was like our friends, just, they were still around, but it was Sandy and I. We took rides together. We went to movies together. We were just together all the time. And we were telling one another, and I don't know if we were telling ourselves, that this wasn't going to be serious. You know, we're just going to be friends. She's saying, I'm much too young, and I'm saying, well, I've got a lot of life to live, you know, and all those platitudes and all that garbage and crap that you throw on. The whole time I'm thinking, God, would I like to be with her? Well, eventually I was. But anyway, where were we? Oh, we were together all the time. And you ever see this commercial for, I don't even remember what it's for anymore, but it's these two blonde-haired, flaxen-haired beauties running towards one another through this open wheat field, this vast prairie. And it's in slow motion, and an Evangelist theme is playing in the background, and they're trucking towards one another in slow motion, and they just fall into each other's arms and collapse. Well, that's what I thought about that. That's what Sandy and I did. Just like two sick people, just sitting like a hand in a glove, two sick people just made for one another. And we were an item, and that was it. We got engaged, we got married, we started having kids. And we were drinking. Sandy was 19 when we got married. I was 23. And neither one of us were mature. Neither one of us knew anything about anything. Her idea of love was coming from her family. My idea of love was coming from my family. And I thought mine was normal and hers was nuts. She thought hers was nuts, but mine was nuts too. So we had a struggle right from the start, and we drank a lot, we played a lot, we fought a lot, and Sandy turned 21 years old, and it was just like the world come crashing down. That's when I first remember it anyway, as stuff starting to go really bad, where she was drinking in town now, and I was getting mad, and we started having kids. My son was born 10 months after we were married, thank you. And I know you guys think about that stuff. Let's see, they got married in January, had a kid in November. Chuck was born, and 13 months later, Chris was born. So we had these two little babies, and life wasn't very good. We had some good times, but we had a lot of bad times as well. And it seemed like we were in constant turmoil. I was working midnight. I always worried about what was going on at home. I worked in a grocery warehouse, and I'd go to work and I'd worry. Is she home? When's she going to get home? What did she do with the kids? Or somebody watching the kids? Is she going to be home when I get home? All these things would go through my mind and my stomach every day. And 99% of the time when I got home, things were okay. An alcoholic goes out and gets drunk. Us, not yet, Al-Anon. We just worry, just constantly worry. And thank you, Blanche, for bringing up the thing about the Al-Anon. That just gives me a pain not in my ear, but elsewhere, when people talk about their Al-Anon. There's some nut out there going crazy, and they say, well, my Al-Anon's going crazy. Well, that person doesn't even know what Al-Anon is. How could they be Al-Anon? I mean, they can be nuts, and if they're not an Al-Anon, they're just nuts. However, if you're an Al-Anon and nuts, you're an Al-Anon who's nuts. Get it straight. I like saying that when there's a lot of alcoholics around, because that ticks them off. I gotta get rid of this thing. As you can see, I don't move around very much when I talk, so it's kind of like, I feel like I'm gonna go through the floor here. Just before we came downstairs, we were watching those goofy video things on TV. My ear hurt, my throat hurt, my eyes are watering, my stomach's upset because I'm nervous. I'm sitting there watching some stupid video thing on TV about crazy marriages or crazy weddings, insane this on TV. Stuff you do, eh? That don't mean anything at all. God, it's weird. Why did I say that? I don't know. It's a cold. Hey, if they had a commercial outlet for snot, I'd be a millionaire. Anyway, we're married, we're having kids, Sandy's going out. One night I'm home with the kids, it's 3:00 in the morning, I haven't been to sleep. I've been up waiting for her to come home, because you gotta wait for her to come home, you gotta make sure she comes home okay. So I'm sitting up there drinking coffee, make sure she's home okay. Then I'm thinking, I think I know where she is. Not only do I think, I know where she is. So all the kids are in bed. I mean, they're a couple of years old. They're sleeping, they sleep all night long. 3:00 in the morning, they probably won't wake up, jump in the car. Drive over to where I think she is, and the lights were on, the cars were there, and I sat out there and fantasized about what I'd like to do. Started the car up and came back home. That proved a lot, didn't it? That helped out. You know what happened? The next morning when I politely brought it up to her, she didn't remember where the hell she was anyway. So I knew where she was. She didn't know. She still doesn't know. I do. And I'm not telling her. But who's crazy? Is it the alcoholic who's sitting in somebody's apartment drinking, you know, blasted out of their mind, smoking cigarettes and eating potato chips? Or is it me pacing the floor at home with two little kids, drinking coffee at 3 o'clock in the morning, driving down the street, leaving the kids home alone, coming back home, and I have not done, haven't accomplished anything except to excite myself even more? Who's nuts, the alcoholic or the non-alcoholic? You know? One night, Sandy came home. It was dark when she got home. I'll put it that way. She came in the door, and I had seen her get dropped off because that was my job. I had to stay up and watch her come home. She came through the door, and I saw her coming, and I was mad because I saw who she came home with. So we had some words, and she said something to me. And I slapped her right across her face with my wedding ring, hit her in the eye. Now, I'm not a violent person. I'm a big guy. I haven't been in a lot of fights, probably because I'm a big guy. And I'm also a big chicken. But anyway, Sandy said something to me, and before I knew it, I had my hand right across her face, and her eyelids swelled up like a pea was under it, you know, and turned black. And it stopped the argument, and we went to bed. Naturally, you know, hey, let's go to bed now. And then the next day was Sunday. We went over to my ma's for Sunday dinner. Now, it's a family disease, isn't it? I mean, I'm married to Sandy. We're family, so I'm affected by this. My kids are affected by this. We go to my ma's. My ma's not married to Sandy. My dad's not married to Sandy. My brother and his kids aren't married to Sandy. We go over to the house. We're having, my ma's a Norwegian and Swede. Oh, God, if she knew I said Norwegian, she'd kill me. My mom's a Swede. So we had roast beef and mashed potatoes and overcooked carrots and that kind of stuff. And we're sitting there eating, and we're talking about football, and the whole time my stomach is just in a knot. Nobody said a word about Sandy's black eye. And there was no way you couldn't see it. Who's affected by alcoholism? How deep does the denial go? Is the alcoholic blind and in denial? Is the non-alcoholic blind and in denial? You know, she drinks. She got drunk. She's an alcoholic. I had all those things except I'm not alcoholic. One night we're at a dance. We're at a wedding dance, a room about this size, like a stone floor on this thing, real beautiful ballroom. And the music's playing. Now, you alcoholics aren't going to understand that. And I know there's at least two alcoholics in this room because I had lunch with them this evening. So I know there's two of them here. You probably won't understand this because by the time this happens, you're so damn drunk you never saw it anyway. So when you're with an alcoholic and you're looking across at them, and they come to a certain point in their life when they take that drink of beer and they look at you and their eyelids crash about halfway down like this, and just like broken window shades in the window, and they just kind of hang there. And then, that's not so bad, but then they start putting their head back. My ears just cleared up when I did that. I think I'll stand like this. Anyway, and that's what happened to Sandy. Then eyelids came halfway down, and she started looking at me like this where I could see her nose hairs, and I thought, it's time to get her out of here, because I, no Al-Anon, no recovery program, no, I knew nothing about alcoholism, but I knew when she got that way, things were going to get nuts. So I told one of our friends to grab the purse. We're getting out of here. I got Sandy up on the dance floor. Now, Sandy's about 5'6". She fits right about here. Well, we danced, and we talked about dancing last night, and I said I'm not a dancer. We were talking. I think Sam and Shirley were talking to us. Sandy always led when we danced. Now, you guys have tugs and barges up here, river barges? Well, Sandy was like a tug pushing a load of barges up the river. But she pushed me around that floor. And we never stepped on anybody. We never bumped into anybody. We floated around so gracefully on that floor. Well, this time, I got her up on the floor, and I'm saying, I'm going to lead this time. And I led her right straight across that floor, and it probably looked like one of them old Wild West trains with the cow catcher on it, because I was just going. Get out of my way. I'm blowing the horn. I'm coming through. Danced her right to the back of the room, and I danced her down the stairs and into the car and drove home. And I did something that, this is just what happened, this is just the way it was. Throw her over my shoulder, carry her into the house, walk past the babysitter, who by this time expected this to be normal, saying, hi, Chuck. Hi, Sandy, how you doing? Carry her upstairs and put her to bed. And then I take the babysitter home, leaving the two and then later on three kids with a passed out body, essentially leaving them home alone. Sometimes going back to the party, sometimes going somewhere else, sometimes coming home and really being ticked off. And that's the way it was. You know, that was our life. And what I'm about to say now is just because I have to say this. I hope none of you think that I'm trying to do anything else to share my story here. Sometimes I'd come home and Sandy be passed out in bed, and I'd get next to that passed out body and figure, this body's mine, and I'm going to take advantage of it. She's passed out. She ain't got a clue in the world what's going on. And here I am, stone cold sober, stone cold crazy, taking advantage of a passed out body. And I'm not proud of that, and I don't particularly even like telling it, but that's part of life. Blanche talked about our old Al-Anon literature. In Al-Anon Faces Alcoholism, the first edition, there's a man who writes a story about just that thing in that book. The whole story isn't about it, but he talks about that in there. When I read that, I got chills. Because, God, I did the same thing. And when I tell my story now, invariably, there's somebody that comes up to me and says, I did that same thing. So I don't feel alone anymore. I don't feel the guilt I felt then. I don't feel good about it. It's something that happened and I can't change it. But if I can share my experience with somebody else that has done that, that's what it's all for. That sharing my past, to me it's like liabilities and assets. You know, my past was a liability at one time. The things that I did that I wasn't proud of, that was a liability. Now when I sponsor guys, and I sponsor a lot of guys, some of them I really, really sponsor them. Some of them have, I think, probably a rubber stamp saying, Chuck's the sponsor, you know. I never hear from them, but they say I'm their sponsor. But when I can share things, or they can share things with me, you know, when they're telling me something that, hey, I really feel guilty about this. This is something that I did, and I say, okay, Jerry, yeah, I did that too. Oh, yeah, I hear that stuff a lot. Because didn't you feel alone? Didn't you feel like you were the only one that was crazy? Didn't you feel like you were the only one that slapped your wife in the face? Didn't you feel like you were the only one that felt like you were unable to put together a marriage that would work? And tried so hard to be a good husband, tried so hard to be a husband that said, you're going to do this and you're not going to do that. And it always failed. And I was a failure. And that's the way I felt. Again, love and hate. You know, I loved her and I hated her. And I thought I was nuts. How can you love and hate somebody? How can that be possible? I'm going to share a little bit about my children. I've got three kids. I've got a son that's 32, a daughter that's 31, and another son that's 28. They've all been affected by alcohol, very, very much affected by alcohol, both in their mother and their father, and their mother and father's reaction to and because of that drug, and by their own reaction and action to that drug. At least one of them is chemically dependent, having sniffed, snorted, poked, thrown in, poured down, whatever he could do with whatever drug he could find to get whatever he could. My youngest one almost died because of alcohol, because of drugs. He has a serious illness, a chronic illness, which he'll have for the rest of his life and probably die from when he does die. Quit school, using drugs. We put him out in the street, took him home. He started using. We met him at the door with a blanket, or a sleeping bag and a pillow. Sandy was in AA for many years at this time. I was in Al-Anon many years at this time. And we said, we're sorry, but we can't live with you this way. Because this is our house and we live here, and you choose the way that you choose to live, you cannot live in our house. Choose to live differently, you can choose to live home. And he took the sleeping bag and the pillow and he left. He called us the next day. He was 150 miles from home, sleeping at somebody's house. And for the next year or so, We'd see him wandering the streets. He lived in a closet. He lived in a hallway. He lived underneath stairs. And he looked terrible. Sandy's dad died during that time. My dad died shortly before this. He went to the funeral, and he looked like something. I don't know where your Skid Row is, but that's what this kid looked like. We loved him. We told him we loved him, but we didn't love his behavior. We couldn't put up with that behavior. He came home one day after about a year and a half of living out the way he lived, and he said, "I'd like to move home again. I don't feel good." We said, "Well, you're welcome to come home if you don't use." He said, "I'm not going to use ever again." He went to the doctor, found out he had this illness, and he quit alcohol. He quit drugs. He quit smoking. He started eating right. He started living right. One day we got a pack of the mail from our local technical college. It was for him. He went back to school, got his high school equivalency diploma. A couple of months later, we start getting stuff from the University of Wisconsin Superior in the mail. I said, "Kurt, are you going to school?" "I'm thinking about it." He graduated with a 3.8 average. And as hard as he went into everything that he did is to kill himself, and he bragged about not living until he was 18. As hard as he went into destroying his life, he went into saving his life. He's going to Claremont College out in Los Angeles right now. He's going for his master's. He's 28 years old. We call him our miracle kid. But you know something? Sandy and I don't take credit for that. You people in Al-Anon and Alcoholics Anonymous helped us to understand what we had to do to maintain our sanity and to turn him over to the God of his understanding, for him and the God of his understanding to work. We couldn't do anything for him. He was destroying our house. He was destroying our life. He was destroying our mental sobriety. And we knew what we had to do. And we did it. Now, I'm not saying it's always going to turn out that way, because it's not. But it did for us, and I thank you people so much for that, having that happen. My kids are little. Chrissy and Chucky, they're upstairs sleeping. They're 3, 4 years old. And I'm home alone, watching TV, not seeing it, just watching it. Sandy's out drinking someplace, bowling or some damn thing. Got the kids in bed because it's wintertime, and wintertime is Superior, 5 o'clock, it's dark. Kids didn't know how to tell time. Kids, it's dark. Go to bed. Isn't that great? Go to bed. Dark. Because then you know what happens. I can get busy worrying, pacing the floor, kicking the dog, whatever I have to do to keep sane, you know, because I'm not nuts. Chris comes to the top of the stairs. "Dad, I need to go to the bathroom." So I go upstairs with her and I take her into the bathroom. Bring her back to bed. Tuck her in bed. Kiss her on the cheek. "Where's Ma, Dad?" "I don't know." Come downstairs. A little while later, Chris is back paddling. You hear little footsteps going upstairs to the top of the stairs. "Dad, there's a boogeyman in my closet." Go up the stairs, look in the closet, look under the bed. "Oh, see, Chrissy, there's no boogeyman here. If there was, I'd beat him up for you." Put her back in bed, cover her all up, kiss her on the cheek. "I wish Ma was home. I wish she was too, Chris. I really wish she was." Here comes those. Chris is so persistent. She got some good qualities from me, and then she got her persistence from Sandy. I'm telling you. Come to the top of the stairs. "Dad, I need you." So I go back up there and do whatever it was she needed to do. Bring her back to bed, tuck her in bed. "Dad, I want to know where Ma is." And I say, "Shut up!" Now, I'm big, and my voice is low, and when it's loud, Sandy says I can't whisper. Here's this little 3, 4-year-old kid laying in bed. What does she want to know? Where's Ma? What time is she coming home? Is she okay? Are those invalid questions? Are those questions so far out that I should get angry enough to scream and spit in her face? Which I did. I remember my son cowering in the corner of the bathroom. And I've got my finger going. And I was one of those that finger the chest, you know? And I'm doing this kind of stuff to that kid. And he's cowering in the corner. And I'm really laying into him. I says, "What in the hell are you, what are you crying about?" He says, "Dad, I'm afraid of you." "What the hell do you have to be afraid of me for? I'm your father." Yeah, it's just silly that he's afraid of me, isn't it? Okay, who do the kids think is nuts? Sandy comes home, whatever time it is, she's got pop, she's got that damn cheese popcorn, she's got candy bars, and she goes upstairs and wakes the kids up. "Here's your candy bars, here's some pop, here's some pop." She's popcorn in the bed for the next week, you know, and she's, oh, she's having fun, they're having fun, and I'm laying in bed just burning. And who do the kids think is crazy? The alcoholic brings them stuff, or the non-alcoholic who is totally stone cold sober, screaming and spitting in their faces and threatening them? Yeah. Who is nuts? It's pretty, and my kids told us that when Sandy was going through her treatment thing, we heard from our kids that, "Dad, you were a lot meaner than she ever was." Yeah, I was. I was so angry. And I took it out on those kids. You know, I don't know about you guys, but you got this alcoholic that's coming home any time of the day or night, and you're so mad at them, you want to just put them out of their misery. I would start cooking this Pyrex coffee pot on the stove, and it would just keep percolating, never stop, and I'd be pouring myself coffee, and I'd sit at the end of the couch, kick the dog off the end of the couch, and sit on the arm of that couch. And I'd look out that window and I'd see these cars coming, you know. We live on the two dead-end streets. We live on the one corner of two dead-end streets. You'd be amazed how many cars go by a dead-end street at 3 o'clock in the morning when you're looking for somebody. And that ticks me off, too. What are they doing on the road? I wouldn't have to look out if they weren't there. So anyway, I'm looking. Here she comes home, you know. All right, here she comes. I got her this time. She gets out of the car, starts coming towards the house, I run upstairs and jump in bed. You know, she fits right here, and I jump in bed, pretend I'm sleeping. Then she comes stumbling up the stairs and feeds those kids all that crap. And then sooner or later, she's in the bathroom doing things that alcoholics do in the bathroom. I'm sure you're all familiar with that, except the alcoholics who you're blacked out and you don't remember doing that kind of stuff in the bathroom. Anyway, she's in there, and they make a lot of noises. And they're pretty cool, actually. They're noises that some of them make in there. And I'd wait to a certain point because I wanted her to be miserable, but yet I didn't want her to think that I wanted her to be miserable. Of course. So, and then I'd go in there and she'd be puking her guts out in the toilet bowl, and she used to have real long hair. That's probably why she cuts her hair short now. But I'd pull her hair back, you know, I'd stroke it back and I'd rub her back while she was puking in the bowl. I said, "You poor thing, you're going to be okay. And inside, what I really was saying, I was like, "Stick your head down the corner." And I'd help her to get back in bed and hating her guts. Once I got her in bed and calmed down, I put my CB making noises that alcoholics make when they fall asleep, snorting and snoring and coughing and speaking unintelligible, well, speaking in tongues probably. And there I am, because I've had all this coffee in me. My eyeballs are just this big around. They're looking up at the ceiling. You ever see those new clocks they got that shine the time right on the ceiling? Well, that's the way my eyeballs were, to be shining lights on the ceiling. And it's like I'd be shaking, just vibrating. And I don't know what it was, from fear, worry, anger, or maybe that coffee that I was drinking. And sometimes I think maybe it's the vibration that puts Sandy to sleep. I don't know. Sandy came home one night, and she came in the house, and she told me she tried to kill herself. And I fantasized her dying. I fantasized her driving that car into the river that was by our house so many times. And it's a real muddy river. And my fantasy was that it would sink down, nobody'd see it. And when they'd finally find her, you know, it'd be, I don't know, the new millennium or something. And I had all kinds of fantasies, and they just kept rolling along. I used to fall asleep to fantasies. And one night she comes home, she said, "Chuck, I tried to kill myself over in Duluth tonight with the car." And she was crying. Well, I started crying. Are you crazy? Don't you know I love you? Don't you know kids love you? Don't you know your mom and dad loves you? Don't you know it's totally selfish to be trying to do something like that? Was there one other selfish person in that house? Was there one other person that was fantasizing almost every time she went out about her dying so I could be rid of her and get to somebody normal? You know, were there two selfish people in there at least? Yeah, there was. One was alcoholic. And everybody knows them damn alcoholics are selfish. There was one non-alcoholic. We're never selfish. Self-righteous sometimes. Never selfish. Yeah. Yeah. Who's crazy? The alcoholic or the non-alcoholic? It's easy for me to know. About this time, Sandy's sister went into a treatment program. And part of that treatment philosophy was that the family members had to go to Al-Anon. So Sandy started going to Al-Anon. And I don't know how many weeks she went, but I liked it because she was going to Al-Anon. I figured everything was going to be okay now. I knew it had something to do with drinking or not drinking. I knew it was some kind of program that people went to. And so that was good. I liked that. Anyway, I took her away on Tuesday night, and she was at a place where she wouldn't drink. So a phone rings this Tuesday night. I answer the phone. It's my mother-in-law. She'd gone to an Al-Anon meeting with my mother-in-law. And my mother-in-law asked me, "Is Sandy home?" "No, she's not home. She went to an Al-Anon meeting with you." And my gut started churning. And then I thought, uh-oh, here we go. She says, "Chuck, she was here with me, but she grabbed her one day at a time and her shoes, and she went downstairs. I think she went to a meeting with Alcoholics Anonymous." And I don't know where this came from, but I said, maybe that's where she belongs. And it must have been where she belongs, because she's been going to those AA meetings ever since then, and it was probably March of 1980. And I thought, all right, she's on the ANA. She's going to these meetings. This is heaven for me. I've always wanted her to stop drinking. And now she has. I'm going to come home from work at night. There's going to be mashed potatoes on the table. My socks are going to match. My shorts will be turned right side out and folded, and things will be in the drawers where they belong. And hallelujah. About time this happens. Yeah, that happened all right. And apparently you guys don't go along with that because you're laughing. She's at the club. She's at the Alamo Club. She's there morning, noon, and night. She takes the car away from me at work so she can drive to the club and listen to these damn AA tapes. These speakers that from all over the country, Texas even from. There's some people from Texas that do that stuff. And she sits there and listens to this little black box. Push the button and listen to Clancy from wherever the heck he's from. Nasty guy anyway. Jeez. Angry, holy moly. And then there's other people that she'd listen to, and she'd come to pick me up from work, and she'd be going, I'd say, "Sandy, what's wrong?" "I'm an alcoholic." I thought, "Well, I'm sorry, hon. Let's go home." "I can't. I gotta listen to the rest of the tape. Call me to that damn set place and put that tape on. I'd have to sit there and listen to that tape." She picked me up at work, laughing. "Oh, yeah," she'd be. "So what's going on?" "I'm an alcoholic. I'm happy, joyous, and free." But in her big book, that isn't even written in there anymore. It's just rubbed right out of there because she put that magic marker on that stuff, that highlighter. Big book's about 4 inches thick from all the ink and magic marker stuff she's got on that thing. And she just kept going there. And she'd go to meetings. And guys would take her to meetings. I didn't like that one darn bit. And then she got a sponsor. She wouldn't tell me nothing, except the only thing she'd tell me, 3 words. Go to Al-Anon. Go to Al-Anon. Go to Al-Anon. Finally, the alcoholic lady said to her, "Quit telling them to go to Al-Anon. Let them stew in it for a while and see what happens. You know, these alcoholics know how to detach, too. Don't let them fool you. They know how detachment is. She got this spiritual leader, spiritual advisor that she had to sponsor, you know, and I, Lord only knows what she was telling this woman and what this woman was telling her to do to me. Cool. And I met her sponsor after one shortly after she got into AA. Her sponsor was a lady that used to drink in the bars that we used to drink in on the wrong end of town. Diane was a big lady. She was tall, and she was like, who was it? Katie Lang sings that song, Big Boned Woman from Southern Alberta. Diane was like that. Diane practiced detachment. She'd rip a guy's arm off and beat him over the head with it. That was her detachment. Well, one day we're sitting at the picnic table, cross-legged, you know, just knees touching, and I'm looking at her, and she's looking at me. She says, I'm going to be going into treatment pretty soon, and when I get out of treatment, I don't know if we'll be together. Holy moly! What do you mean you don't know if we're going to be together? I mean, we drank 13 years. You've been drinking and raising all kinds of cane, and now you're sober, and you're telling me you're not going to be with me anymore. And scared the heck out of me. And she said something else to me, and it wasn't necessarily that night, but it was the same thing that hit me. She says, my sobriety comes first. Oh, yeah, right. Your sobriety comes first. I should come first, then the kids and the rest of them down the line. See, I didn't understand that if she didn't have sobriety, she didn't have anything. I didn't understand that then because I didn't know anything about Al-Anon or Alcoholics Anonymous. But I did know one thing. I was a manipulator. I was, and I am, to this day even, eh? So I told her, tonight I'm going to Al-Anon. I'll get her off my back. Restore the shine to the halo and all that. Those women that go to Al-Anon will tell me how to put up with this alcoholic over here that's sober. I never knew her when she was sober. And that's what she said to me. We don't know one another sober. We went to movies and we drank. We went to plays and we drank. We went to ball games and we drank. We went to dances and we drank. We made love and we drank. Everything in our life revolved around alcohol, usually beer. All right. So I'm going to Al-Anon. Oh, I hated it. God, I hate it. This is like going to have root canal or something, you know? Well, I heard about these Al-Anon women. When I was 4 years old, I went to kindergarten. My mom had me by the hand, brought me up the stairs of John Erickson School. Sandy's got me by the hand, leading me up the steps of 1609 John Avenue Superior. We walked through the door, and she goes, I'm going in there to a meeting with Alcoholics Anonymous, and Al-Anon's up there, third door on the left. I walked up them steps down that hallway. Here's this old smoky yellow sign hanging on that door. It's a beautiful house. House is like 100 years old. And this is what I heard come from behind that door. Gee. Oh. When I always talk about being the only guy, I thought, yeah, I know how that is. Testosterone levels drop, and it's just terrible. Anyway. I had pride. I didn't have any self-esteem, but I had pride. So I'm going to sneak in there, you know. And I went to push the door. The top of the door stuck, and the bottom would open up a little bit. So I was going, rah. And honest to God, this happened. I pushed on that door. I fell right in the middle of that room. And these women are going, oh, it's another man. Come on in. What I was concerned about was what the hell they do with the other man. I don't know if you've ever seen that Twilight Zone movie about how to serve your fellow man. Anyway, there was one other man there. He's a little guy. Would fit right about here. I sidled up next to that guy, sat next to him. I talked to him a little bit, and I don't remember what I talked about. And then stuff went around the table, and he shared. The things I remember about that meeting are my feelings. Not what was said, but my feelings. I had fear. Then I had, they understand me. Then I had, they know what's going on inside of me. Then I had, it's like, they wrote my story. They were talking what was going on inside of me, and I could not believe it. And the little guy said, next week I'll take the meeting. All right, I'm coming back, because I want to know what this little guy's got to say. So I did. I came back, and the little guy, he talked about his life, in Al-Anon before and after, and we have a discussion meeting. But he practically took the whole meeting and did what I'm doing here. Excuse me. And that was the last I ever saw him. He never came back. He worked for the census. It was 1980. He worked for the census. He was in town for a few weeks. Went to Al-Anon. God sent that guy to that meeting. He sent that guy to that meeting. And I said, man, my fantasy, because I still have him, is to someday be telling my story and have that little guy stand up and say, I'm that guy. And come and give me a hug. That's my fantasy. And I realized that guy's, God, he's going to be pushing 90 years old. I think someday Sandy's going to pay some little old guy $20 and go up and hug that guy, will you? Yeah, you don't have to remember very much. Just say, I'm the guy. That's all. So anyway, I start going to AA. I'm sucking everything in. You people are sharing. I'm taking. You're sharing. I'm taking. You're sharing. I'm taking. Boy, I'm really flying high. I knew all about the steps, all about the traditions. I knew all that stuff. And then it started getting old. And then somebody said, get a sponsor. So I got a sponsor. And then a guy started coming to meetings who sounded a lot like me. And eventually I asked him to be my sponsor. And he said, I'll tell you what, why don't we co-sponsor one another? And I said, okay, because at that time we were the only two guys. We worked the steps together. We studied the traditions together. We went to meetings together. And my Al-Anon life started turning around because of sponsorship. See, I had only superficially heard of sponsorship. And until I got into it and started doing it and having a sponsor, it remained superficial. Same as the fourth and fifth step. You know, I didn't do a fourth and fifth step for a long time, but I never told anybody I didn't do it. When it came to a fourth-step meeting or a fifth-step meeting, it was kind of like, I'm left out in the cold, but I'm not telling anybody I didn't do it. When I was a kid, a busload of us kids went out to this haunted house out in the country, and it was dark out there, and it was scary. And all the kids went through the haunted house except me. It was dark out, so I thought, aha, I'll run around the outside and come out where they're coming out. They won't even know that I didn't do it. All the way back to town, those kids are laughing and having a good ball, saying, wow, wasn't that fun? We went through that haunted house. I'm going, yeah, yeah. Because I missed it. I thought I was so smug, I didn't need to do it. I'm smarter than them. I don't have to go through that stuff. They've got the experience. I've got the why. With the help of my sponsor, I went through a fourth and fifth step. With the help of my sponsor and some other people in Al-Anon, I started getting involved in service work. I got involved in the group, the district, the area. I'm a panel 32 delegate from Minnesota North. Service work has enhanced the serenity that I've found in Al-Anon. And it's got me to meet other people, to go to other places, to do stuff like this, and to just know that Al-Anon is alive and well, seemingly. I don't want to be preaching. I sponsor a guy that's been in Al-Anon about 5 years. He talked to me one day, and his wife's an alcoholic. They're driving down the street, and they're behind this car, and it says, honk, if you know Bill W. He says, who the hell is Bill W.? Been in Al-Anon. 5 years. Doesn't know. Sure he goes to the meetings. He goes to a couple, three meetings. Sure he does the steps. Sure he takes, you know, he's doing all this stuff. Now he's got guys he sponsors. But he knows nothing of the history of Al-Anon. Is that my fault? Is that your fault? Is it our fault? Is it his fault? We can pass the blame around all over the place, but until we start doing something about it, I don't know how healthy Al-Anon is. Without a history, without a past. Because I think it was Mahatma Gandhi said, our history is our future, or our past is our future, something like that. And I believe that. We've got to look at where we're going and where we've been. Well, I'll get off that soapbox. I want to tell another story about sponsorship. I have a sponsor now, a different sponsor. It's my third sponsor also. Fits right here. Little tiny guy, bald head. I got a whole head of hair. I got this big hairy thing hanging off underneath my nose. He's got a little Frenchman mustache with about 17 hairs on it. He's my sponsor. His name is Dave. He's a wonderful guy. I had some physical problems this summer. I was supposed to go to Alaska. I couldn't go for a while because of some things that I've got going on with me. He took me out to his cabin out in Wisconsin there, and we spent the day out there, and it was just so much fun. I mean, I shouldn't say fun. It was enjoyable. I was with Dave. We had dinner. We had breakfast. It was just great. And he's my sponsor. He doesn't ram a rod down my throat if I'm not doing the steps right. He doesn't grab me by the ear and haul me off to a meeting if I missed one. He doesn't beat me over the head. He's killing me with kindness. He's my sponsor, and I want to do stuff because I like Dave. He's my friend. His suggestions to me are merely that, suggestions that I can use to enhance my serenity. My father-in-law, it was our 24th anniversary. Sandy and I went out to dinner at a real fancy place, which we usually don't do because I'm a tightwad. We went out to lunch, our dinner. We went to an open Al-Anon meeting, and afterwards we had planned to come home for a romantic evening. We can be romantic, sober. You guys taught me that alcohol is not a prerequisite for sex. You taught me that love is just a four-letter word with a lot of meaning. And I like this thing here. I thought about that today, about love. How much is love? Anyway, we're sitting at that open Al-Anon meeting. An Al-Anon friend of ours comes in, gets between Sandy and I, and says, Sandy, your dad's been hit by a car. We got to go to the hospital quick. And me, in my denial, says, it's probably nothing. Sandy said, it's something. It's really something. When we got there, he'd been killed instantly. He was having some problems. He was having TIAs. It's a horrid thing that happened to him, and I feel bad for the kid that him. He was 18 years old. But my father-in-law, who didn't want to suffer, didn't suffer, and doesn't. We suffered somewhat. But you know who came to us? Alcoholics came to us. AA people came to us. Al-Anon people came to us and kept coming to us. You helped us out. You fed us. You offered to take care of the kids. You did all this stuff for us. That's what Al-Anon's about. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. That was in January. In April, I get a phone call from Dave, my sponsor, and he said, buddy, I need you. I said, what's going on, Dave? I lost Justin. I said, what do you mean you lost Justin? Justin was his 15-year-old son. He says, Justin hung himself in my bedroom. Justin had a bad day. He started a treatment program for adolescents. He had a problem, so he chose a permanent solution to a temporary problem. Dave was over in Duluth, about 15 minutes away from me, and I was praying all the way over there, God, help me say the right thing, help me do the right thing. When I got there, I didn't have to do anything. I just had to let Dave talk and hold Dave and hug Dave and let him cry, and we cried. AA people came. Al-Anon people came. At the wedding, the funeral, Al-Anon people, AA people were there. That's what the fellowship's about. It's a spiritual program of recovery, and recovery is love. That's the way I want to look at my fellowship. Sure, we have fun. Sure, we laugh. I joke about the women in Al-Anon. I love them to death because they saved my life. It's a serious program, but it's a loving program. That's the way I want to look at Al-Anon. Two people, both equal. Saturday morning, I'm going to my Al-Anon meeting. The phone rings. It's for me. I'm angry because the guys, and we got about a dozen of them that go to our Saturday morning meeting, we go to breakfast, and we're not very spiritual at breakfast. Phone rings, that's me, I'm talking to this guy, and he's called me before probably 50 times. Oh, I'm contemplating suicide. She's gone. She's never coming back. She's still drinking. She's still using. I don't know what to do. I'm about ready to end it all. And I've told him time and time again about Al-Anon, invited him to come, and we've made dates to go to meetings, broke every one of them, always had the flu. And he told me this day, I said, let's go to the meeting. There's one today. I can't go. I'm really not feeling well. I said, you know what? I bet if you went to an Al-Anon meeting, you'd feel better. Because I got to tell you, this is my experience. If I'm feeling poorly, physically or mentally, I go to an Al-Anon meeting. When I leave, I feel better. If I go to an Al-Anon meeting, I'm feeling good, and I'm full of spirituality, and I'm on top of the world, and I can share that, when I leave, I feel better. It's a win-win situation. Can't get any better than that. Chuck, I don't think so. Okay, call me when you're ready, quick. 10 seconds later, phone rings. It's a woman, 86 years old. Chuck, I want to let you know, I want you to talk to the Al-Anon group. I probably won't be coming to your group anymore. She had been coming for about 6 weeks. Probably won't be coming there anymore. She said, I just wanted you to let the group know the gratitude I have for helping me save my sanity. They helped me to detach. They helped me to let go of my alcoholic son, who is 64 years old. I found my son dead. I have no guilt whatsoever. We did all we could do for him, and we turned him over to God. He's in God's hands now. He's home with God. I just wanted you to thank the group. Two people, two phone calls, within a minute of one another. Two equal people. They both had equal choices. They both had the opportunity to go to Al-Anon and save their sanity. One is still out there suffering as could be. The other one lost somebody, a real tragedy, lost a loved one, a son. And she says, thank you. Thank you, Al-Anon, for saving my sanity. What choice did you make? Pretty clear to me where I'd go. Okay, I'm going to tell you one story. I'm sitting down. Holy moly, I've been up here too long. That clock doesn't work. Okay, people ask you, you know, they always ask, why do you go to Al-Anon? Why do you go to Al-Anon? Okay, I'm going to tell you this. We've been in Al-Anon for 20 years. This happened a few years ago. I fixed up the front porch. Looks pretty cool. Looks really nice, you know. And I've got a little round table out there with two chairs. And Sandy and I sit out there and goggle at each other. Are there kids in here? We still get turned on with one another, you know that? We can sit at that table and look at each other and just, we're in love. Ah, that's great. I think it's just wonderful that we're in love. Anyway, I digressed from the point I was about to make. That happens sometimes. She's cooking. She doesn't cook very often, but today she's cooking. She made meatloaf, mashed potatoes, corn on the cob. Hey, this is all right. I come home from work. It was one of the few times I was working days. Come home from work, and the house smelled great. Walked in the house. She says, let's eat out in the front porch. Had the windows open. The breeze was blowing through. We sat down to eat. We're sitting at the table. She's passing me the food, and I'm putting it on my plate. She's putting it on her plate, and we're staring into each other's eyes like a couple of lovesick kids. And she started to butter the corn. So she's buttering her corn one way. I don't want to make any hand gestures here. She's buttering her corn one way, and I'm buttering my corn another way. And one said to the other, at some point in time, you're buttering the corn the wrong way. And then the other person said, I'm afraid that I'm not. As a matter of fact, it was you that showed me to butter the corn this way. I certainly did not. And this discussion on buttering vegetables increased. And the next thing I know, I had corn kernels spitting out of my mouth. And this is where Al-Anon kicked in. I had that cob of corn in my hand, and I said, the hell with you. And I threw it right down the middle of my mashed potatoes, and I got up and I left. Detachment. Right. We live on Lake Superior. Beautiful, beautiful Lake Superior. We live on a bay on Lake Superior. But a couple blocks. You're right on the water. So I took a walk down there. And as I'm walking down there, we pass the Blue Heron. And that Blue Heron, or I pass the Blue Heron, neck is shaped in an S. And I'm kicked at this alcoholic who always thinks she's right. Boom, that Blue Heron went down and come up with a fish in its bill. You know how they flip them around, down it went, and I thought, that dirty bugger's got its supper. Mine's sitting at home. Lord only knows what she did with it. Well, I'm walking down the railroad track, and all of a sudden I'm thinking about, you know, actually it was kind of silly. You know, I knew we were arguing about corn. We've been married 30 years, and we're arguing about corn, you know. And do we argue about big things? Well, that's big. I mean, corn can be a big thing to argue about. Relatively speaking. Anyway, I said the Serenity Prayer, and I'm thinking about Al-Anon, I'm thinking about steps, you know, I'm doing this 10th step, and I'm starting to laugh about it, you know. Corn, for God's sake. And then we found, all right, I walked up to this bridge on the Imagine River that I fantasized through driving into and drowning, and there was a kid and a black Labrador and a stick. And we had just had our black lab put down. And I watched that kid and that black lab and that stick. And man, it was beautiful. And I'm thinking, this is a beautiful place. This is a beautiful day. I have it made. Said the serenity prayer again, and I thought, it's time to go home and make amends to Sandy. Well, suddenly there's these fire trucks going by, an ambulance going by, and a cop car's going by, and just for a fleeting instant, this just went right through my mind, was going, I hope the hell she thinks I jumped in the lake and they're coming to pull me out, you know? And isn't that just like an Al-Anon? You ever see a price in the magazine of a car, and it says, subject to change without notice? Serenity. They could put it in all the Al-Anon books. Subject to change without notice. So I got home. I walked back home. You know, I come through the door. And this is, if you people are new in this program, believe me, this is the way it's going to be if you practice your principles in all your affairs. I come through the door. I said, Sandy, I want to apologize for the things I said and the way I behaved in this argument. And she said, yeah, me too. And she was doing the dishes. And she said, did you have a nice walk? See, AAs can detach also. Did you have a nice walk? Yeah. And she called me my love. We're taking a sign language class, and the other day she signed in my love. She signed my name, my love. I was bald, because I love when she calls me that, my love. She says, did you have a nice walk, my love? Yeah, I did. So, come in, give her a hug. She says, would you like your supper? Yeah. She walks over to the refrigerator, pulls out this plate, and saran wrap. Looked like a saran wrap teepee. Because the corn cob is just stuck right down here. Pretty strong mashed potatoes that she had there. But she put it in the microwave, and I had my supper. And you know, that's why I go to Al-Anon. I keep going to Al-Anon because Al-Anon helps me solve the problems of everyday living. And I just want to thank you people so much for what you've done for me. I thank you for allowing me to do for you. You know, that's what it's about. We're all voluntarily here, I'm hoping. I do know an Al-Anon, a wife that had little cards made, and her AA husband had to have them signed when he went to an AA meeting. He had to bring them home to her. Honest to God, the guy committed suicide. I'm serious, he did. Who's insane? The alcoholic who's trying his best and can't succeed? Or that non-alcoholic who's going stark raving mad? Who's insane? I thank you so much for inviting me here today. You taught me that alcoholism is a disease. You taught me to love the alcoholic and hate the behavior. Because I loved the alcoholic and I hated the alcoholic and I thought I was nuts. And when you told me, love the alcoholic, hate the behavior, it all became very clear that nothing personal was being done. She would have treated Bill Clinton that way. Well, probably any woman would treat Bill Clinton that way, but I mean, she... So, thank you very much for having me. It's been a real pleasure.